My own name is Timon Schröter. And these are my colleagues, Konrad Rieck and Sören Sonnenburg. Three of us are PhD students at Fraunhofer First here in Berlin. And there we work in the so-called Intelligent Data Analysis Group. My own research focus is drug discovery, which doesn't have anything to do with smoking pot or the like, but rather with developing new medications. Gunnar, who was the speaker in the, on the 21st CAST Communication Congress, was supposed to be here too, but I think he's not here for some reason. Otherwise, we could have thanked him for some cool slides that we could use from him. So thank you anyway, if you can hear us. The slides and also my notes are on the web at this URL. So that's timon.info/22c3. There's some write-up and some comments on the slides and everything that didn't fit on the slides themselves. And also the slides are there already. So in case you want to look at them now. If you have questions, ask any time in between. Don't wait for the end. Typically at the end, we only have time for 2-3 questions. And I don't mind at all. So if you have a question, just... So if you have a question in between, just raise your hand or yell out or whatever. You can also come up here or go to the microphone there. That's just fine. Okay, so who has heard the talk just before this one, the one at 7 o'clock about developing search engines? Quite a few people. Oh, cool. Great, because they also explained one possible application of what we're doing now. And they have this magic black box they called a supported vector machine, and we're going to explain this in a little bit more detail now. Has anybody used machine learning methods themselves? Yes, some people. Anybody with an in-depth knowledge of machine learning already? Okay. Somebody doing research themselves on machine learning? Even that? Okay. Anybody? Okay. Everybody else has probably used a spam filter at some point in time. So, yeah. Okay. Good. Now, what we're going to do today is, first I'm going to give some background on machine learning in general, mostly on supervised machine learning and classification. I'm going to explain some methods and tools, support vector machines and kernels, which is nothing like a Linux kernel, but a machine learning tool, which is completely different. Then I'll spend most of the time on showing some cool applications. And also show some colorful slides and videos and everything. So once we're past the ugly formulas in the first part, there's not too many, but there are some. It's going to be really colorful and then even animated. We also brought some demos. So. One example probably everybody in this room knows is spam classification. So the goal is to classify new emails into spam and non-spam. And one way of doing this is learning from previously classified emails. In supervised machine learning, we are usually treating objects that belong, or if we are doing classification, we are treating objects that belong to certain classes. So for every object, we've got a feature vector containing some information about the object and a label. So in case of the apples, you can see on the slide, we've got classes plus class natural or plastic apple and the associated labels plus or minus one. And the feature vector could contain information like the volume of such an apple, the mass, maybe some averaged information about the RGB channels or anything else you can imagine, like any information that might be useful for classifying. Now the task is starting from some examples where we know the features and the labels. We want to build a model that is then able to make a prediction. So we would start out with the four or maybe more apples on the left-hand side, build a model, and this model is then able to say, what this one up here will be, hopefully. So we're going to build a model that's essentially a function. The input of this function is a feature vector, like some information about an object, and the output is supposed to be the label that we're estimating. And almost everything is unknown, so that's why we're doing the learning in the first place. So now, a little bit more formally, we're observing n training examples with features and labels, and we're trying to learn a function that maps from the features to the labels to be able to predict unseen examples later. Now, underlying assumptions are that the examples are generated from a statistical process, that there is a relationship between the features and the labels, and that the unseen examples that we're going to classify later are generated from the same or a similar process, otherwise the whole thing is useless. And that's the most ugly slide with the most formulas, so never mind if you don't understand all of them. The idea is going to be understandable anyway. On the top, we've got a hypothesis class, which is just all functions that we could use to map from the features to the label. Now, to distinguish which function is better than another, so we can choose the best model out of a lot of different ones, we use a so-called loss function. The loss function is just a function that takes as input the real label of an object and an estimated label from one of our functions, here denoted h of x. And the most simple loss function is just the 0-1 loss function, which basically means if the predicted label and the real label are the same, then the error is 0, and if they are not the same, then the error is 1, or the loss is 1. This is already really useful. It's just counting errors. It works. In a lot of cases, we want to make a difference depending on what kind of error this is. For example, for spam, imagine once in a while you do get a spam email in your inbox. This is not so bad, you can just delete it. If, on the other hand, the spam filter starts eating all your normal email and classifying the spam, this is much more annoying. So probably want to punish that kind of error harder and give an error score of maybe 5 for doing it this way, and then missing some spam, maybe you just get a score of 2 or something like this. Anyway, this function just says how bad an error is, and can be anything. So now that we have a loss function and functions that we want to evaluate that might be doing the job, what we would want to do ideally is use an infinite number of examples to really know which function is really the best one. Practically, this is just written up here in mathematical language, which basically means evaluating on all possible examples what is the expected loss, and then we take the function with the smallest loss. That's all really nice in theory, but in practice we only have a limited sample of data available, so we need to get around work with what we have, and just finding the empirical minimizer for the small sample we have is usually a really bad idea. You'll shortly see why. Of course, we want our model to generalize. We don't just want it to learn what we already know, but we want to extrapolate and interpolate. So if you look at this plot here on the left-hand side, imagine the black dots are the ones that we use in training about choosing our model and tuning parameters. If you're just looking at the black dots and we are then considering certain functions to approximate what's behind, the red line and the black line, then we see that the red line is relatively close to all black dots, but the black line goes through all black dots. So just looking at the black dots, we might choose the black line and think it's perfect, it reproduces exactly what we know. But then if we test this with some more data points that were not used in the training, that's the blue crosses here, then we see that the black line is horrible, while the red line works reasonable. So we don't want our model to be too complex. So the red line is relatively simple, it's relatively smooth, while the black line is really wiggly. So on the right-hand side, you see some typical error versus complexity plot. So if we make our model more and more complex, we see that the training error gets smaller and smaller. It can even be zero at some point in time, which means that our model completely learned the training data. But then on some test set with unknown, previously unseen data that was not used in constructing the model, the error gets smaller until some point, and then it gets worse again when the model overfits. That's what it's called. That's what the black line is there. So that's what we want to avoid. So the important thing here is both to evaluate how good the model is already and to tune parameters. We always need to train on some data and then test on data that was not used in training the model to evaluate how good this is. And cross-validation is just one means of doing this in a systematic way. This means basically like dividing all data you have into portions and then training on some part of the data and evaluating on the other and then the other way around, and then you redivide your data and everything. So always to always evaluate on unseen data. Now some more colorful slides again to get some impression here what this mathematical stuff really means in practice. Suppose again, same example as before, we want to classify apples into plastic and natural apples. One thing that might work already is just a very relatively simple model where we put on the x-axis how red they are, and then on the y-axis how heavy they are. If you consider the plastic ones are just, yeah, just like this one here maybe, and the other ones are real. They probably, the most real apples or natural apples are heavier than the plastic apples, and the real ones are usually red too, at least from the sample we see now. Just using either property does not work. Both together do work, and we can just draw a line to separate these two classes here. Just going to some more abstract notation, but so now we're talking about just different properties and different classes, but it's just this same thing. So if we use a line to separate these two classes of objects based on some information about them, on these features, the question arises, which of these two lines do we want to use? Which one is better? And one result from statistical learning theory is that the largest possible margin gives the best generalization. So for the data we already have, it's no difference. There's no difference depending on which line we use. But for unseen data, the best largest margin is best. And this is just a line, but this applies also to more dimensions. So it can also be plane or hyperplane in however many dimensions. The result is the same. Now, mathematically, we can represent this hyperplane by the normal vector, by its normal vector. And then we can construct a function where we get the label, just the predicted label, just as a sign. So basically, we scale the data and normalize it so that the normal vector has length 1 and can be at the origin, which is not just background information also. And if we do that, then we get the sign of the function just as the predicted label. We can do this all by construct the norm vector that describes our hyperplane just by linearly combining our examples. And it turns out that when we do this, we don't need to use all the examples. We get the best results if we use only the ones closest to the hyperplane. All other alphas here in this linear combination can be zero, and the ones closest to the hyperplane, the ones that support the hyperplane, the ones that define the hyperplane, are called support vectors. This is also why this model is called support vector machine. I'll show a demo of that now. So suppose we've got some objects of some class, whatever, here. Just click some points. And then we've got some objects of a different class, also somewhere here. And if we want to separate this, we can just train our model. This will take a moment because it's impinged. Okay, we see there's lots of errors being made, so maybe we should punish errors somewhat harder. Okay, that's already better. So, I'm missing some lines here. Okay. Okay, last afternoon there was... Okay, I'm not going to go into the code now because there's some... Was appeared some other was supposed some, to be some other markers, but we'll see more of that later. Back to the slides for now. We can play with this demo maybe after the talk. This is if we have some time then, and also play with the code a little bit. Okay, now this works all very well for data that can be separated linearly. With a hyperplane, or with a plane in three dimensions, or with a line, if it's just two dimensions. And if we have a case like this one here, then we can see directly, looking at this as humans, that this is easily separable with a nonlinear function like this one. So what we'd like to do is find a way to apply this method, which works very well for linear stuff. To nonlinearly separable data. And one easy way to do this is to map our features, to map our input data, to be more precise here, from this input space to so-called feature space, which has many more dimensions. I'll show an example shortly. And after mapping this data from this input space it normally lives in into a feature space with more dimensions, we can then separate the data linearly in this feature space. So, for example, if we've got data looking like this here, and we use a polynomial kernel of degree 2, then the mapping looks like this here. And then in three dimensions, we see that it's the data is easily separable just using a plane. And the same thing can be done for data that normally lives in something like 50 dimensions and can map this to some 100 dimensional space or even higher dimension, a couple of hundred dimensions. And in that space, we can then separate it just using a hyperplane, which is very nice because all results from learning theory and statistics and everything else we know about linear models then applies because we map the data in a space where it is then linearly separable. And this mapping can become computationally expensive. And there's a trick to avoid the actual mapping by using so-called kernels. That's where this word comes in. In the end, everything can be reduced to doing dot products in the feature space. And a kernel is a function that does the mapping and computing of the dot product that we actually need in the real implementation at the same time, and is usually even relatively cheap. So that's a nice way of cheating out of some computational expense here. And there's many possible kernels, and like functions that can do this mapping and dot product computation. Depending on the application you want to do, depending on what your data looks like, there might be a kernel that is just suitable to separate it really well. And one kernel which works really good usually, which is really, really flexible, is the so-called Gaussian kernel, sometimes also called RBF kernel. And I'll show some of that in the demo now. So if our data looks somewhat more ugly, so it's not just linearly separable, but maybe it's more like this, with some more blue here. Okay. Then linearly, this is of course not feasible, and we can try, but nothing good will come out. Just not worth the effort. But then if we make this more flexible, we see that we can really separate these points. So the actual separation takes part in a high-dimensional feature space that we cannot see. And if we now, just to plot this thing, somehow get the information back to get these colors, then we can see that this is a decision line here, the one, and then the other lines are just showing where the output crosses plus one and minus one. So the ones that are just here at the border are the support vectors, like this one here, this one, this one, this one. They really define where the hyperplane will be that then finally separates, and on the other hand, we've got the other margin here. So this is how big the margin is, and then we've got the separating line in between. Okay, so so much for the theory. We are now getting closer to the applications. Current techniques can be used for classification. That's what I've shown so far. They also work for regression. If we want to estimate some real-valued function, then we can do that too, including interpolation and extrapolation. And it can also be done with support vector machines. We're done not just estimating one hyperplane, but many. But it works just the same way. Otherwise, we can do novelty or anomaly detection. In that case, you start with a cloud of points, just some data essentially about you don't know too much. And then you can find out what is essentially similar somehow and what is different. And that can either be new if you're doing research and looking for some something new, like for example, you want to treat patients and look for the new aspirin or whatever. Or it can also be anomalies, whatever. For example, in network traffic, so for intrusion detection and that kind of thing, it's also interesting to just look at different packets. Anyway, you know what I mean. In current research, for simple objects with simple properties, this all works just great. And current research then is being done to apply this all to more complex objects, to treat many classes, to do more complex learning setups and to break complex properties. Complex objects could be, for example, XML pages. We could just treat them as text, but then we would lose some important information. I mean, this information structured. We've got labels and values, and we could maybe get more out of this if we really use the structure somehow. So just somebody just has to construct a kernel that works on XML pages, and then we can probably classify them really good too. Many classes could be funny stuff, like we don't just want to know whether it's Apple or whatever, IBM, but maybe we want to find out some other brands of notebooks too, just by looking at pictures of them, or whatever you can imagine. It might not just be A and B, it could also be C, D, and E, and F, and whatever. There are lots of different classes that objects can belong to. There's lots of applications for this. I'm not going to read the whole list, but intrusion detection is one, obviously. Document classification, like spam classification, load monitoring of electrical appliances. That one's funny. Like fake interview identification. In social studies, a lot of times the interviewers don't really interview as many people as they're supposed to, but they interview some people and then they just fill out the rest of the questionnaires themselves because it's much faster. And then it turns out that there's structural differences in how they're filled out, and just by looking at the results, it's relatively easy to find the ones that were faked. And all kinds of things like that can be done. The ones I picked out for today to discuss in a little bit more detail are handwritten letter and digit recognition. There's probably quite a few people here with PDAs, and that's methods that are being used there too. Drug discovery I put in here, but I'm going to skip that because there's not enough time. We're going to do some examples on document classification, which is a serious topic, but inside the serious topic we also did some fun stuff just to present here. I'll talk about gene finding and about brain-computer interfacing. Save the best for last. If you want to try some of this at home, then here's some pointers on where you can find software that will be helpful for you. LibSVM, for example, is an implementation of an SVM that you can use directly in C++. And there's also some other toolkits and projects that have everything to get you started. And you can, if you know C++ or Java or whatever, you can probably get a spam filter running within, I don't know, depends, an hour or so. Feel really good. One benchmark for handwritten character recognition is the MNIST benchmark. There's 60,000 examples of written digits that look like these here. and there's 10,000 that are just used for testing, then later. And now the goal is to train an SVM or other model, model of your choice, basically, to recognize in 10 different classes which digit is written here. Of course, this can be extended to letters too, but this benchmark is with just with digits. And what works well here is an SVM with a polynomial kernel. Depending on the degree, it considers correlations of different degrees. For example, if we choose a degree 5, then it will consider fifth order correlations. So each pixel with so many pixels around it. This already leaves only 1.4% error. The winner from last year, or it's last year was still the record as far as I know, was a translation invariant SVM, which is somehow adapted to make this even translation invariant, which means basically that if the digit is the same but just shifted to the right or to the top or whatever, then it will still be recognized. And this improves a little bit more. Okay, we are skipping this one. And come to something that most of you know, source code of computer programs. Now, what do we see here? We, or actually Conrad, took source code written in different languages, C, Java, MATLAB, and also just some shell scripts. And then, I'm not going to explain everything of this in detail, but following this pseudocode algorithm here, we get a visualization of this in two dimensions, which is really useful when looking at new data. For example, if you look at new data and you want to find out which features are useful for really distinguishing different types of documents, for example, and which features are useful, and how is the data structured? Is there, in this case, for example, this works relatively well because we see that all the Java stuff is here in this cluster, and then we've got the C source code here, and then we've got the shell scripts here, except for one, which somehow looks like C. Then we've got MATLAB down here. So in this case, we could easily separate this with something like an SVM. If we can see as humans directly in this visualization that it's separable, then it's an easy task. So the features that were being used here, which are 2 grams, work relatively well. 2 grams are just frequencies of 2 letters following each other. So 1 gram would basically be just counting the different letters, how often they appear. 2 grams are then pairs of letters and so on. So we can also use 3 grams or whatever. And 2 grams already work very well. It's not even necessary to use more than these to distinguish in this case. This can also be done for binary code. In this case, it's not letters, but it's just 2 grams of bytes, I guess. So they are easily separable too. And now we come to something more funny. We just took random files from the Linux kernel and the OpenBSD kernel, Linux 2.6.12 to be exact, and OpenBSD 3.6, I think. Yes. Applying the same algorithm here, we see that the two classes do overlap in this visualization, but there already is some distinction. Like if we as humans were asked to make a decision what a new file coming out somewhere here would be, then we would say OpenBSD. And if it comes out somewhere here at the bottom, it's more probably Linux. If we're just using 2 dimensions, like this pseudocode that I just showed before, generates a lot of high dimensional feature vectors, and for the visualization we're just using the first 2 dimensions, but there's more that are ugly to look at, but for an SVM we can use them, and if we just use these 2 dimensions for an SVM we get 73% correct classification, which is what we would probably guess just by looking at the data. So like guessing 2/3 right sounds about sensible. If we use 50 dimensions, then an SVM can separate 95% correctly, which is not bad considering that all the license information, all the header information, all that stuff was cut out. So it's just the real source code that it's left, apart from the most obvious easy features. This also works for code written by different people. It's also funny. Same programming language, same project, just who wrote which file. If there's enough data to learn from, this can also be classified easily. Okay, now to a bioinformatics application. Everybody knows that the way we come to being is coded in DNA, basically. More exactly, more precisely, in the genes, in the chromosomes. And I have to look on my notes here because I'm not an expert on that field myself. In the genes, there's essentially DNA which does code for example, protein shapes and other relevant used information. And there's parts of the DNA which does not code for anything. So the introns are non-coding, the exons do code for protein. And there's so-called splice sites that are just the borders between exons and introns. And it's an interesting problem to look for these splice sites. So what needed to be developed was an SVM that we just put a DNA sequence in, and then we want to have markers for, yes, here is with a very high probability a splice site, and there is no splice site, and there is a splice site, etc. So we just want to pipe some DNA sequence through this and get markers for the splice sites out. And to be able to do this, a new support vector kernel was developed, which takes windows of 150 nucleotides. These are, if they come from known splice sites, which can be found in biological databases, then these are considered positive examples. And then from other places, we get negative examples. And this new kernel basically counts matching blocks between two windows it compares. And then from comparing to windows, we can, that's all the kernel needs to be able to do. If the kernel can compare to windows and give some sensible distance measure, then the whole support vector machine framework can be applied using this kernel, which works really well. So finding splice sites can be done with something like 99% accuracy, which is really nice. And now we're coming to something sci-fi like. How much more time do we have, by the way? How much? 30 more minutes. Oh, okay, lots of time. Great. Okay, so that's our bosses with EEG caps on their heads. So everybody who's doing research on this stuff has to volunteer also for some experiments. And that's where they all look funny. So the goal here is to develop something that can distinguish what people think. And not only that, but it's supposed to work online and in real time, so we can steer some device just by thinking one thing or another. Now, this is a difficult problem because in human brain, there's a lot of different things going on at the same time, always. Like different parts of the brain are active doing different things, and so there's lots of signals being generated. And by the time they go through the skull, and by the time we try to pick up these signals on the top of the scalp by just some gel electrodes that we put on the head, the signals are really noisy. They are really weak, and there's lots of different signals from different sources interacting. So it's necessary to separate the real signals that we're looking for from a lot of noise and signals from each other, which is similar to the cocktail party problem. And interestingly, the same algorithms can be applied in both cases and work well in both cases. And the nice thing about the cocktail party problem is that we can show this and make this more clear by playing sound samples, then you know directly what I'm talking about. So the cocktail party problem basically is you're in a room which is crowded with lots of people who are talking, a lot of people are talking, and you want to basically know what everybody says. You want to listen to one person, for example, and then you want to listen to another person, or maybe you want to listen to two people at the same time, or three, or whatever. And so somehow you have to get the signal you're interested in, the voice you're interested in, out of the whole out of the whole mixture. And technically this is possible, at least in theory, if there's more microphones than signal sources. Then it's possible to decompose these superimposed signals. And I've brought some sound samples to illustrate this. And since we tested this now, this will hopefully work. Okay, so now I'm first going to play three different mixed signals. And then I'll play the decomposed, separated signals. So since you know there's three separated signals, you know beforehand that there's three different elements to look for. Maybe you can find out something just by listening to the mixture. We'll see. And so okay, so you can probably identify traffic noise and cars directly. Maybe there's something else. I'll play the second. Maybe it comes out better there. Hands taken by the lighting harmonies and made in a trail of longer. Okay, this voice was a little bit more clear here. There's also a musical instrument, but it's really hard to hear. Maybe I can. No? Come on. Hands taken by the lighting harmonies and made in a trail of longer. Okay, now if we now put all this into independent component analysis, we can get three separate signals from these mixtures. And the first one is this one here. Okay, this is just the traffic noise, this was probably easy. Then the second signal we get is this one here. So this was really weak in the original. And the third signal we are getting is this one here.
And taken by the light in her arms, I may without fail, at long and dear last, suffer the first...
Okay, so... So this stuff really works. And we can do the same thing for the electric signals that come out of a human brain. So we get separate signals. It turns out that this algorithm works even better for electrical stuff, because for sound, we have a lot of echoes. If we go back two slides to this here, we don't only have the original signals on microphones, but also echoes from walls and other stuff that's in the room, which makes this even more complicated, because every signal source creates not only one signal, but it also creates a whole bunch of echoes, which would then all have to be separated, so it's a really hard problem. For electrical signals in the brain, it's not so bad, because the echoes are really weak and die off relatively quick. So these algorithms work better. Here, what this is supposed to symbolize is looking from the top at a human head. This is to be the nose. This is just symbolized. And here's a bunch of electrodes on the head. If we just want to separate two different classes of thoughts, for example, movement imagination, this works really well. For example, you imagine moving your right hand, or you imagine moving your left hand, or your right foot on left foot, or whatever. Then, as you all know, there's different parts of the brain for the right and left part of the body. And just thinking of moving this body part activates certain parts of your brain on that half. And the easiest way to do this is just with two pairs of electrodes. This already works somehow. If we use more electrodes, for example, 27 in this case, then we can apply more sophisticated algorithms to get noise and everything else out. If you only have two pairs of electrodes, then we have not much to work with. But with more electrodes, we can eliminate artifacts, for example, from muscles on the neck or from the muscles of the eye, because they're relatively close to the brain and they cause lots of noise there. They can be eliminated more easy with more electrodes. We usually work with a sampling rate of 1 kHz. This is just shortly showing this. The last decades, people have mostly worked with average signals. So they recorded people sleeping or reacting to something or whatever really often, like 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, and then averaged all the signals. So they got relatively smooth signals like these black lines here. But if we want to build a brain-computer interface that you can use in real time to steer some device, then you can only use the one signal you have at that moment. So you have to work with this really wiggly, noisy line. So it's a complicated problem. And this is the setup we use. First of all, there's the human performing some task, thinking of something, imagining movement, for example, and which results in the brain emitting signals. And they can be acquired by putting electrodes on the top of the head. It's theoretically also possible to put electrodes inside the skull, but this is only done for example, Parkinson's patients or people like that, because somebody who's healthy would probably not want electrodes in their skull. But anyway, it even works with electrodes just on the top of the scalp. These signals are pre-processed in a quite complicated way. That's where this cocktail party stuff comes in, like the independent component analysis and a lot of other spatial and temporal filters are being used to separate the signals from the noise and the signals from each other. The result of this pre-processing are feature vectors that are then passed to a classifier, which then emits a control signal. And the classifier can be, for example, a linear SVM, so a linear support vector machine, as I explained in the first part of the talk. We even use 64 to 128 channel electrode caps. The most important thing is that there's enough electrodes on the primary motor cortex here, but then the other electrodes help to get the noise out, so they're also useful, even if not directly. And now let me just show some videos of this thing in action. This is our boss sitting in front of a computer, as you can see, and he will now just play the game that we just call Brain Pong, which is self-explanatory. It's just a game of Pong. Only he's steering it just by imagining movement of his right and left hand. So there's some misses, but most of the time he hits it. Okay, so 20 bits per minute is not really amazing for modem, but for this device it's good. There's even a two-player version of this game. So what you cannot see is that there's a second person here on the right-hand side, and as you can see, the ball going up on the one side and down on the other. So it's just the other person has the turned-around screen, basically. And Guido, the guy on the left-hand side, is going to win because he's practiced a lot with this stuff. And the idea is to let the machine learn. But then, on the other hand, if we are doing the experiments ourselves a lot of times, then of course we learn too how to imagine more clearly the one thing or the other. So both sides are learning, and Guido just yes, most practice, and also so he's got something like 95% classification accuracy, or even higher most of the time. So he hardly misses. Okay. Game is just about over, I think, too. So some concluding remarks. There's quite a few computational challenges in machine learning. Algorithms like support vector machines, as they exist now in their current implementation, can work with 100,000s of examples. Usually model parameters need to be tuned. For example, we need to find a good level of complexity for the problem that we are currently treating. And there's so usually a lot of cross-validation runs are done to tune model parameters well and to really find out how good the model is. For this, we need computer clusters and job scheduling systems, and a lot of times we also want to just try out some new idea quickly. So the code that does the real computation is often implemented in C or the like, also uses Atlas and other metrics computation libraries. But on top of that, there's mostly MATLAB or Python. Some groups are switching to Python now because MATLAB is just so terribly expensive. And machine learning is an exciting research area involving computer science, statistics, mathematics, and all kinds of application areas. There's a large number of present and future applications in all situations where data is available but explicit knowledge is scarce. There's an elegant underlying theory of which we have not seen too much today. There's lots of questions to study, and we're always looking for motivated people, PhD students, postdocs, and also students, like Hiwis in German. So just let us know if you're interested in this stuff. Thank you for your attention. And thanks to all contributors. There's quite a few in our group who work on this stuff and who donated slides or helped in another way. And special thanks to Gunnar Retsch, who gave a talk last year and from whom we could borrow most slides for this talk. Thank you.